Welcome, or should I say, welcome back. It's been a while. You know, sometimes life has a way of telling you to pause, to take a breath, to let the salt dry on your skin for a moment. And that's exactly what we did. After visiting Rizal in Bali, Minicho in Mozambique, and road trip to France to talk to Billabong Europe GM Simon Charlesworth for our sustainability chapter, we tucked away our well-worn bags high up in our closets and took a moment to recalibrate. This pause, though, wasn't just about rest. It was about reflection. It was about dialing in the travels and stories, inviting more friends to join our monthly escapades. And speaking of new friends, we're thrilled to announce that Duct Tape Theory has found a new home in Australia as a Trax Magazine exclusive production. It's a partnership that feels as natural as the pull of the tides, born from our shared passion for surf culture and storytelling. For our first journey together, we touch down in Morocco and make our way to a small fishing village called Tagazu, the center of Right Hand Point's tagine and North African hospitality. Morocco is home. Well, not far from it anyway. As I spend my summers in the Spanish Basque Country, I know this North African nation just 8 nautical miles or roughly 15 kilometers across the Strait of Gibraltar all too well. With its short flights from most European cities, Morocco has long been a favorite for travelers seeking a taste of Africa. But it's not just the local hospitality, the mouth-watering cuisine, or the rich culture that draws people here. It's the surf, some of the very best in the world. Morocco's affair with surfing began back in the 60s, when American soldiers stationed at Kenitra Military Base first discovered waves at Medea Beach. But that was just the beginning. With an expansive 3,500-kilometer coastline stretching from Algeria to the Sahara Desert, Morocco has since become a mecca of its own kind. One of world-class waves, attracting surfers of every race, every creed, and every craft. But among the treasure trove of waves, one small village stands out. Tagazu, or how one surf magazine likes to call it, Morocco's Gold Coast. Tagazu is to Europeans what Bali is to Australians, or Central America for Americans. From Agadir to Tamri, you'll find an abundance of waves. From points to beach breaks, reefs, and A-frames, it's one of the richest stretches of surf on the entire planet. And at the heart of it all is one family, surf royalty, if you will, the El Kalanis. Sahad and his brother were the first to surf the points around the village, christening many of the spots with the names that now roll off the tongues of surfers worldwide. Munia, Sahad's daughter, is the glue that holds the surf community together. She knows everyone, and everyone knows her. As you walk through Tagazu, it's impossible not to feel the energy of the place. Surf shops and cafes line the streets. Boards lean against every other wall, and the air is filled with the chatter of surfers swapping stories in different languages. But to really understand how the sleepy fishing village became a global address for surfers worldwide, you need to go back to the beginning. That means back to Sahad and his brother. Sahad El Kalani is one half of that legendary duo. He's witnessed change around here firsthand, from a quiet fishing village to an important hub of surf culture. As I sit down with Sahad, his daughter Munia by his side to help navigate the language barrier, I can't help but feel a sense of awe. Here's a man who has lived and breathed Tagazu's surf scene since its inception, who has watched it grow and change, and who still exudes an infectious love for the sport, the town, and the community it has created.
I'm from Agadir. Me and my brothers, we are first surfers. We began in 78 exactly. Brothers maybe later, a little bit later, 80. I spent all my life in Anchor Point, and we built houses there, because before we rented houses and rooms 10 dirhams, I remember. 10 dirhams a day. It was all the surfers. Most of the surfers like were like hippies, not like now. Now, they have cars. They rent cars. They have surfwear everywhere. I remember about surfwares. When OP, Pacific Ocean t-shirts, or Sandek, or lot of surfers. When, Quicksilver. When the surfers came here, they bring these t-shirts with them. So, when they leave, they let that t-shirt with good marks, good brands. We had a friend, Prosper and Jackie. C'est pas grave. They took these t-shirts and they began to do copies. Very, very good copies. And the first we did is a t-shirt with kangaroo and I don't remember how, maybe 20 kilometers in the back. Okay, kangaroo. We do the same exactly. We did it and we sell a lot of with a camel with 22 kilometers anchor point. And we got a lot of money with this.
As you can hear, Saad's life is rich with experiences, each one a story waiting to be told. But to truly understand his journey, I asked him to take us back to where it all began.
The 70s. When we began in 78. I began in 79, me and two brothers. In the beginning, there was only a few surfers, like hippies. We saw them in Mystery in 70s, 76, 77. So we saw only vans, old vans. Most of them, it was a Ford Transit. Australians, English, New Zealand, a few French, or Portuguese, Spanish later. So when we saw them, when we saw them, we tried to do the same. We speak with them. They are very good guys, very nice hippies, but not like surfers now. They changed. So after we saw them surfing Anchor Point, no one, not everybody knows why it's called Anchor Point, because near the point there was a factory, and they fishing factory. They fish tuna, and when the factory stopped, they took anchors from the sea and they put them near the road. So the first when the factory stops, so surfers when they came there, they saw the point anchors and they said anchor point, anchor point, anchor point. Later, a lot of French media surf station, they came there, they said anchors factory. Long time they said it was anchor factory. It's crazy. They never asked the locals why it calls anchor point.
We just heard Saad's memories of legendary Anchor Point. This iconic break, shrouded in mystery, has gone by many names throughout its history. But among the local surf community, one name has stood the test of time.
Madraba is madrag in French. It's a system how they catch tuna. Madraba, we still have in Morocco another madraba in the north. So they put nets inside the sea and they took the naps ammonia, nets, le filet, gros filet, nets with big anchors. So tuna comes and they go inside and they could. But the real name is madraba. And the tar root was very, very small, only fishermen, and they don't have an engine in their boats. I remember all this. And after the surfers, we have more and more surfers. A lot of them, they came from with the vans. I know how they do. The Australians, when they leave Australia, they leave for 1 year. They go to Europe. They surf to England. After they go to France, they buy a van from in Holland or Belgium. It's very cheap. 5 or 6 surfers, they buy this and they come to Morocco. Here they stay 2-3 months, only surfing and smoking. In the beginning of the surf, when we began, we knew only all the surfers in the world, and all the surfers, Roche du Diable, Devil's Rock, and Banana. And Anchor Point is the first. Anchor Point, Mystery Killer Point. And Boiler. We have never heard, Tamri too. We have never heard about Desert or others. Boat Point, I don't know them. Now I know because, but before we have never heard about this. Anza, because the town is called Anza, but it was forbidden to swim there. We saw the wave, it's a very nice wave. Not only there. Anza, but there are many factories there, and Simon Factory. And when you swim there, you have a problem with skin because it's all polluted. Lot of pollution. And Alice.
Like for Anza, for example, there used to be a concrete factory there, and the water was so polluted that no one was allowed to swim or surf. Yeah. Everyone can have any skin problem because of this. And now they removed most of the factories. The concrete factory is gone like 6 years ago, so it started to clean up. So less factories, so the wave is more surfable.
Like Anchor Point. We surfed there two times. We surfed there. And after, but it was a little bit polluted, but not like Anza now. And after they built the harbor, they cut it. And the surfers, with whom we surfed in Anchor Point, they told us that Anchor Point will change. The wave will change. They will not be the same. I said, well, they are crazy. Why? It's very far. They said, no, sure. When the harbor will have influence, sand and everything. And it's true. Because Anchor Point now is not like Anchor Point before. I remember, we have photos, Anchor Point before it was a wall, vertical wall. With now, more tubes, more bars, yeah. And before we have only one bar, in the takeoff, you take it and you have a small section, barn, and another one front of our house, exactly. I remember when the first time I saw sometime in the barrel, it was Rory Russell. He was sponsored by Lightning Bolt. But Rory Russell was very good fight, very, very good surfer. We saw him in Anchor Point. And after we had Gary Elkerton, one of the best surfers in the world, I remember.
Saad's knowledge of the area runs deep, and his passion for waves is contagious. As we talked, his excitement often led our conversation down fascinating trails. While he and his brother were the first to pioneer the points around Tagazoo, they weren't alone in shaping the region's surf culture. Others soon followed, each adding their own chapter to the story.
So the most of them, they serve Anchor Point, Mystery, and Killer Point. Most of them, because the firsters who were coming here, they were very good surfers. Not like now. Now we have only big surf riders. Anchor Point, Mystery, and Killer Point. And after, when the surf began to be known here, Roche du Diable, Devil's Rock, Banana. Where we began? We learned to surf in Banana, Devil's Rock, and the Crocro. We gave names to these spots, me and brothers. The Crocro, because it's like a crocodile. The Bach, because we are both there. And Banana, we gave the names. And after, we came to surf Anchor Point in 81, I remember. It was very, very big. And then really dangerous. When you see the waves, it's easy. But when you are inside, it's very dangerous. And when we were in the water, we are not very good swimmer. When we went to the water, we all the time ask to surfers, big surfers, Australians, they are very big. Yeah, keep an eye on us. When we want to take a wave, we tell them, we go, I go.
And then there was a story with the nose guard.
I remember the first time we saw the nose guard. Because we were surfing at the Anecdote Park. We were surfing Anchor Point. It was very, very, very small. And one surfer he lost his eye. It was very, very, very bad. And I remember we were very shocked. And we don't surf maybe 1 week. And after when we wanted to go to the water, me and brothers, we put tennis ball, we cut it, and we put it in the on the nose. And after, we saw nose guard, the surfboards. We think about this before them.
And as it's only fitting for surf royalty, he tells me about that time he met the Moroccan king at Anchor Point.
One day we were in the water and the king comes, our king. He came and one surfer, I was with him, and one surfer comes and he told him, please, tell. I want to tell you something. Tell to the authorities not to build something in Anchor Point. And he says, I promise you, no one will touch this point. Because I told him, but Tarazut exists with Anchor Point. If they kill Anchor Point, they will kill Tarazut, sure. And Tamraft too. Tamraft is also, it was very, very small. Small, and the land was very cheap. No surfers. When the surf begins, it's same for Tarazut. It was very small village. With the surf, we had more and more surfers. We saw German surfers, Italian surfers, Tasmania, from everywhere we have surfers. So all the economy turns around the surf, all this. And Tamraght and Tarazut exists with Anchor Point. And economically, it's very, very good. It's not, and the impact is not only in Tarazut, but very far in the mountain inside. Same. You saw how many surf camps, how many shops, how many things turned around the surf. And socialement parlant, socially speaking, you can see how the surf changed the mentality of people. Children, they all have something to do when they wake up in the morning. They say they know that they are occupied by something, a good thing. They learn to surf to surfer. They sell surfboards, wax. They teach. All the children are very. They learn English. They are very, very open, and they the tolerance to other child in the mountain, and they are very different than other children in our other countries, because when they wake up in the morning, they go to the sea, they meet English surfers, Jews, French, Australians. They married with girl surfers, and they go to Norway. Maybe 20 of them, I know all of them.
And they always come back,
all of them. Yeah. Laden, Moroccan, Laden. The Moroccan DNA, they cannot. I just met a very good surfer, Jan. He 3 years he didn't come, a very good surfer. He was in France. He came and told me, "Wow, Saad, I just want to eat bread, Moroccan bread. I just want Moroccan food." He was very happy to be here just for food to meet people. It's crazy. Ramzi, same. Ramzi and Otman. Ramzi, he goes everywhere and he comes back.
And just as I thought Saad is out of stories, he tells me one last one.
So it was very, very hard to find resin and fiberglass. Impossible to find. And I remember we have a friend who was working in Agadir in a factory.
This one.
In a factory who are making tables and boats with fiber. And we asked him to bring us some resin. He did it, but the fiberglass, it was impossible. So when we fixed the surfboards in Tamraght, in Devzorg, we put resin, and we don't have, and there were dogs. I remember one dog there, we called him Tansu. He had long hair. We cut the dog here, and we repairs. Yeah. And after we put the farine, flour by gear, we took and we put. But before the fiber, it was the dog's hair.
As we leave Sahad's house overlooking Anchor Point, it becomes clear that this village is more than just a collection of waves. It's a community, a way of life, a spirit embodied by the people who call it home. And if Tagazu were a person, that person would undoubtedly be Omanchufani. Born and raised among the very points Sahad and his brother pioneered, Oman is the quintessential local. He's hospitable, passionate, funny, smart, and just a bit mad, but in the best possible way. Oman is a product of Tagazu through and through. The salt water runs in his veins, and he's a great ambassador of the big wave community in Morocco and around the world. His infectious energy and deep knowledge of the area make him the perfect guide to the people and the soul of Tagazu and its lesser-known neighbor, Tamrat. He's an incredible host. He speaks candidly about the changes he's witnessed over the years. On the one hand, Oman recognizes the opportunities that have come with the growth of tourism and the influx of surfers from around the world. He's seen new businesses open, jobs created, and a general uptick in the standard of living for many in the community. But he's also aware of the challenges that come with rapid development. He speaks about the strain on infrastructure, the cultural clashes that can arise, and the risk of losing the unique character and charm that makes Tagazu special. Through it all, though, Oman remains a fierce advocate for his hometown. He's determined to see Tagazu thrive, but not at the cost of its soul. For him, the key's balance, embracing the opportunities of the future while holding tight to the values and traditions that have always defined this special dot on the map.
So yeah, I grew up in Agadir, which is the main town. 15 minutes drive from Tagazu Tarya. So we used to drive, or our parents used to drive us here to surf all the time. And it's been crazy to see the development over the years. But like I often say, what Mexico is for Californian and what Bali is for Australian is what Morocco is to European. So as soon as the big storm hits their country in the winter and it's cold and it's depressing, they come to Morocco. It's a cheap flight, a quick flight, good food, good waves, and the weather is way better. So I'll compare that to those two spots in the world. And yeah, we now have a lot of people from all around the world that comes in the winter to surf, you know, but most likely back in the day it was mostly European that used to come, and now it just took an important spot as a surf town in the world. Tagazu especially, nobody really knows about Agadir anymore. They just know more about Tagazut, which is pretty crazy.
Oman is the guy you want to have in your crew. The life of the party and super passionate. Traits that seem to go hand in hand with big wave surfing. But when it comes to his hometown and its development, his fun-friendly demeanor gives way to a more serious tone.
Like back in the day when we started surfing, like more than 20 years ago, it wasn't that many surfers, but it was a couple, and like the Tarek and his brother, and the one guy we called Psika, Christophe Shemsdin, or Zuhair, which is the brother of Sad, who has the first house at Anchor Point. These guys were the older generation that took us under their wing at Anchor Point, you know. But we had a little rat pack of 10 of us that go surf as soon as we didn't have school. And we'll just chase some spot, and really, like, we were just pushing each other. And then when we got to surf all those points, so when we were 10 years old, my first time at Anchor Point, that's when this big dog came in the picture and took care of us and was super nice to us and taught us the respect you need to have in the ocean, that surfing is not like, this is not a circus, and that's where we had our surf education from, you know. Say hi, wait for your turn, and everybody used to get waves. All the locals at the peak. Somebody miss a wave, one of us miss a wave. Oh, no worries, you go on the next one, it happened, boom. You know, like we, when I say we, is like my friend and Ramji and his brother Samir and Lou, this is the rat pack I'm talking about. We grew up with a beautiful surf education when we respect the elders and we got our wave. And I see this becoming less and less, you know, in a page, like people are just like paddle out. It's just a circus sometimes, and I miss that honestly. But it's come with the development, you know. People, it's not because they have a passion for it. It's because either there's money in it to open a surf camp and be a part of this, or because it's like like yoga has becoming like a trend 15 years ago, and surfing has been the same, you know. So it's kind of sad, but it gives a lot of opportunities to people from here to get jobs and to meet people and to open their mind and to travel the world because they can make money in the winter. So it's a 50-50, and I'm not saying it's all bad, but it's not all good. And so growing up here and see what it becomes, I'm happy at the same, because it's the same everywhere around the world, but at the same time, I'm a little sad because some of the main important points has been lost, which is respect the elders, wait for your turn. So like, I travel the world and I have friends all around the world, and I'm able to surf some of the most like craziest, perfect secrets wave around the world because of the respect I give, you know. And you give respect, you get respect. But when you just started surfing, you shouldn't be expecting everyone to respect you right away, you know. You have to pave your way, and pave your way is that by let your surfing do the talking. And I think this is really, really important for the new generation to listen to this and try to just embrace the lifestyle and the passion of like, hey, wake up in the morning, check the surf spot. You know, it became so easy to watch the webcam, the forecast, watch all the clips on Instagram. You know, like back in the day, we had surf movies that come out and we're just like, wow, like you saw that part, and we just listened to watch that part just before, so we have the music in our head. You know, that's the kind of passion I see leaving the surf culture and the surfing world, and I miss that. But I see guys from my generation working on making surf movies again and making punk rock cool and all this stuff. So good job, you know, like on the people that don't care. But like, because I've seen it before, it's hard for me. You know, the others, they arrived 10 years ago, like 5 years ago. You know, they didn't see the way I saw it. You know, like every hotel that has been built here, they weren't there. Like where I have my condo, where I have my apartment down Tarazut Bay, used to be a ranch. Like my parents' friend used to have a ranch, and we used to go with my school, ride horses and stuff. That's where they built my residence. So, you know, I bought my apartment there too, you know. I'm so happy to have such a nice place, 5 minutes driving from Anchor Point.
Passionate about his hometown, Otman is equally committed to big wave surfing. He's become Morocco's export to the global big wave scene, and he is a household name in legendary spots like Mavericks, Jaws, Nazaré, and anywhere around the world.
Honestly, since I'm like 10, 11 years old, I've always been the one that pushes, you know. Even when I was skating or when I was surfing, I always had that little thing that I want to push, I want to go a little further, I want to see how far I can go before I get hurt, or like stuff like that. And I always been amazed by the pictures of big wave surfer. I remember watching Flea jumping off the cliff at the 80, and I was like, wow, can you survive that? And then I saw Tyler Knox in 1998 at Todos Santos, and I was like, wow, you can do that. And I had like Mark Healy on Outer Reef. He was young, like a photo of him. I think he was 18, but so, you know, to tell you. And I was just amazed by that. And I always wanted to surf these waves. And when I was in France at the boarding school, honestly, like, I always been like super amped to surf big board and big guitar-y and all those big wave spots since I'm 15. And I really loved it. And everything started with a dream, you know, with following my dream. And my dream was to push my own limit, to try to be on big wave spot and catch the biggest wave that come to me and ride it well and get sometimes the biggest barrel I could. And I just pushed myself, and, you know, I never wanted to compete with anyone else. And then when you surf big wave, you compete against yourself and the ocean. So you got to be healthy, you got to train, you got to get more experience. And big wave surfing is more like a marathon. So it's not like the competitive surfing, which is a sprint. You do not qualify at 25. Besides a couple guys, you're done, you know. Like big wave surfing, I feel more confident now than I've ever been. And I know that in the following years, I'll be even more confident. And you look at guys like Pete Mel and, you know, Twiggy and all those guys, you know, they caught the biggest wave maybe sometimes between 30 and 40 years old, you know, besides Pete, who caught it at 51. But experience is everything in big wave surfing, and It teaches you so much about life in general and how to be patient and how to get over your fear and take your determination, you know, not into like stupidity. Like you can be stupid in big wave. You're not going to last long. So it's this whole package that I really then fell in love when I got into this world, you know. And like people will think you're crazy, but no, you're a calculated person when you surf big wave for a long time, you know. You don't go on stupid wave, like you try not to, but there's always that thing that is 50-50, and the one that you think you're not going to make and you make are the one that stick with you forever. So that's, of course, a little bit of craziness, but there's so many different people in the big wave surfing, and when you go out there and if you interview any of them, everyone is so rich in terms of knowledge about life in different stuff, you know. They're passionate people, and there's so many things you want to pick their brain on. And like, you know, I've hung out with so many guys and girls that surf big wave, and everyone has such an amazing personality, and you can tell we all have something in common, but we can be very different at the same time. But we have this thing that is like this determination to be at your best physically and mentally, to ride the best wave possible. And when it comes to you, you're so stoked, and you just look at the journey more than the moment, you know?
Oatman's career began like many others on the competitive circuit, but he soon discovered that his true passion is away from the confines of traditional contests.
I used to love competing when I was young, you know, but I love also just the fact that I was with all my friends and surfing with everyone and having fun, and then get a couple like stuff when you get, you know, on the podium. And I did a couple little results in not major competition, you know, when I was young. Nothing crazy, but still like a couple international contests that I've been a part of, like the King of the Groom, when I qualified for the main event and all the stuff. And I loved it, but I remember that then I lost and I'll be bummed for a couple minutes, and then I'll go out and surf all day and it's like nothing happened. You know, I didn't give one or two shit about like losing, you know. Like I was like, okay, I lost, I'm just gonna go watch Ramsey win tomorrow, you know. Like it was really like something that I didn't hold onto that. I was just like, okay, let's do something else. And I was like, okay, you know what, I love surfing, and that's not the contest or losing at a contest or winning a contest that will make me, you know, stop my passion and what I live for and what I drive for and what I breathe, what I, you know, like surfing is everything for me, really. Like I can't imagine my life without surfing. So I just was like, you know what, I'm going to keep surfing. And I always loved that big wave free surfer image of the guy, you know, in the magazine, and a guy that you don't see much on contests, but he's scoring and he's always like in the board short, getting like water shot on secret wave and on missions, and have tales to tell. So that's what also like drive me on that, you know, in a way. And I like to compete when I play ping pong or soccer or all this stuff. I want to win, you know, like who doesn't want to win? Have you ever seen someone who say, I want to lose, I want to be ugly and broke, you know, like no one ever, you know, you always want to win. You always want to be successful. You want to always feel good about yourself. So it wasn't just like something that will make me not like surfing, you know? So I just decided that my path, and I was really aware of like how hard those guys ripped at a certain age. And I knew that I was a little late, you know, late bloomer. And I remember my coach, Philippe Malvo, telling me, bro, you're going to surf really good in your 20s. I'm telling you, just focus on what we're going to work on from now on. And I was 15 years old. And I remember at 19, 20, I started to really, really, really enjoy my surfing and really enjoy the way I surf too. And I knew at a young age, you know, I grew up with Ramsey, who is one of the best surfers in the world. And we always go on surfing bigger waves together. And I was like, being always like, sometimes, like I say, like sometimes a standout, I'll go on the big one, I'll pull in anything and I'll get good barrels. But like, I knew like technically I was far from being able to qualify one day on tour too, you know. But like I say, if you want to be good in big wave surfing, you got to be a good surfer too, you know. So it was something that I were like related. I could use what the surfing I had in small wave to the big wave. And that part too made me really enjoy the process, because like, I improve a lot my small wave surfing after being on the run for big waves, like being chasing big swells. I come back and I surf way better than before, you know, so it's funny.
Our talk moved from ocean giants to the challenges within. It's a topic that often surfaces when discussing Morocco's top surfers, the so-called Moroccan curse.
I know, like a couple nights ago, we're talking and I say, fuck, what will be your dream? And I say, anchor point to be a left just for a week, you know? But we all goofies. That's true. But at the end of the day, fam, we're having so much fun on our backhand, and Ramsey became one of the best backhand guy probably because we have so much rice, you know, in the barrel and doing turns. And yeah, it's just crazy, man. Like, everyone is goofy and we have so many rights. It's the land of rights. That's why I used to spend my summer in Indo to have my left fix, you know. And as a goofy, you can tell whatever you want, but if there's a 1 foot left and a 4 foot perfect right, I'll go serve the 1 foot left. I don't know why. If there's a right and a left, I always look at the left. I don't know why. Natural footer, they're not like us. But I feel like we're just different in that way. So it was just, sometimes I think about it and actually I really love to surf on my backhand. I really enjoy surfing on my backhand. So yeah, I mean, it's not a curse anymore for me.
Oman is the perfect host on his home soil and the ideal ambassador to represent Morocco around the world. As he travels, he carries with him the essence of his homeland, sharing the spirit of Morocco wherever he goes.
What I take is, you know, my happiness and the education my parents gave me here and being really like respectful of everyone and everyone's home when you land on someone's land, you know. So I take that with me everywhere in the world. And after that, my personality is really like, I'm really social and I like to share and I like to learn and I'm happy about life, you know. I choose to be happy, so I'm always smiling. So that's more of my personality that I take with me. And what I bring back is, usually I bring a couple friends that I met, you know. Like, I'm like, hey, bro, like, you're super cool. You've been my brother, like, in Mexico or in Cali or in every places or in Tahiti. Like, you come to my home and come surf with me, you know. And then everyone that I brought here always had such a good time and people love them, you know. So yeah, I think that's what I do, you know. I travel, I make some friends for life, and then I want to share with them my home and show them where I'm from, because it's pretty unique, you know, Morocco. My home means our lifestyle, you know, and the different landscape we have. Honestly, when you come to Morocco, like, there's so many different ways, but like, some places look like Western Australia, some others look like, you know, like a beach in France, some other look like Mexico, you know. We have all of that in one country. And also, like, we do the way, like, how we eat, you know, the cultural and the food stuff. On Friday, it's couscous time, and like, you can go in the street and there's no one. Sometimes my friend will be like, why will we go surf now on Friday? It's going to be busy. I'm like, no, brother, you know, they go to pray at the mosque and then they go have couscous with their family. So I use that time to go surf, you know, because surfing is everything for me, like I said. So it's just those little things. And then there's so many character here. Our humor in Morocco is really unique. And then, like, you have guys that sell, you know, their stuff at Anchor Point. They're amazing. This guy Friday, he has the best, like the best quotes, you know, to sell. And then you have, like, all the like I say, like, how people are when you're like, hey, you come out of the water, they're cooking a tagine. They're like, no, you sit with us and you eat. And my friend is sometimes like, oh, really? What? Oh, we don't have four. And I know, you sit and you eat, you know, like, boom. And they give you like the best part of the meat and they give you everything. So I wanted to show them that hospitality, and that's what Morocco made me the who I am as well. So that's what I took with me when I travel. So then they understand me more. They're like, oh, okay, like, I just thought you were super nice, like, you were one of 100. No, we like that, you know. So at the same time, I try to show, like, to show them around and everything. There's so many different special stuff you can show them. And we have a very, very different culture. Every time I bring someone, it's like nowhere they've ever been, you know.
As Otman speaks about the delicate balance between progress and tradition in Taghazout, It's clear that this small town has a knack for producing individuals who embody resilience and adaptability. And perhaps no one represents these qualities better than Ramzi Bouhiam. Ramzi's journey is a testament to the power of perseverance. A decade on the qualifying series, multiple heartbreaks at the cusp of qualifying for the Dream Tour, and then, just when he finally made it, a season-ending injury that forced him out of his debut year on the Championship Tour. But his story is not one of defeat. It's a story of relentless determination and the ability to rise above adversity. As the only pro surfer from the Arab world to ever make the CT, he carries the weight of representation on his shoulders. And when he's on, he can outsurf just about anybody on the planet, proving that his journey has been one of growth, not of stagnation, of resilience, not of resignation, and of stubborn belief in himself, in his abilities, even in the face of seemingly insurmountable challenges. But perhaps Ramzi's greatest strength lies in his honesty. He openly shares his struggles with injury, mental health, and personal losses, shedding light on the often unseen challenges of pursuing a dream at the highest level. One note, when I sat down with him to record this chapter, Ramzi was an alternate injury wildcard for the tour. Since then, he's joined the Dream Tour full-time and is currently preparing for the 2024 Olympics in France. But make no mistake, his journey of overcoming setbacks and betting on himself might be his most significant accomplishment yet.
Well, first of all, it started in Agadir, down south of Morocco. That's the city where I was living with my brother, my dad, and my mom. I went to school there and stuff. That's where I grew up. And my dad used to take us a lot to the beach, me, my brother, even my mom, because he used to love fishing. He was fishing a lot, my dad. So we'd always be around, you know, the sea and at the beach all day. And I started standing up on the boogie board. Honestly, I was starting, you know, I was doing boogie board a lot. And I was just hanging out playing soccer on the beach, just spending the whole day at the beach, right? And my older brother started surfing before me. And then he was like, man, you should try surfing, Anna. And I tried after like, I think a year or something, or even more of boogie. I tried and I don't know, I just clicked really fast, I guess. And then, we went to Walidia, to Surfland. It's the surf camp where I like pretty much everything started for me, where Laurent Miramon kind of like, you know, saw, I guess, the potential I had from the start and told my parents, like, maybe your kid has some, you know, have something special in this sport. But I was playing soccer too on the side. Soccer was my main thing, you know, and I loved soccer and I was pretty good at it. and then my dad came to me after like, I think, 6 months. And he was like, what do you want to do? You want to go soccer or surfing? And I just went surfing and I quit soccer. It was pretty hard, honestly, because I loved it. But I guess I loved surfing more. And so I kept going a lot to Surfland. Every holiday, every school holiday, I was there. It's up north. It's like close to Casablanca, Walidia. Super nice place to surf and to learn. And they have every type of waves too. I loved it there. And just being around kids too. It was amazing memories, the time I had in Surfland. And then not even a year after I started, maybe less, I did my first contest in 2003. In Mohammedia, it used to be the Grommets Trophy, which is, I think, the king of the Groms now. Back then it was called the Grommets Trophy. And they had like a contest, I guess, in every places in the world. And the final would be in Cap Breton in France with all the best of each regions. Yeah. And I won in under 12, and came second in under 14 for my first contest ever in Morocco. So I won my ticket to go there, but my dad thought I was too young, so I never went the first year. And then the second year I went, and that's how I clicked with Quicksilver as well. And that's where my story with Quicksilver started. And I went there and everyone was baffled because I was a little shrimp, man. I was so skinny, so small back then. And when I got there, the Quicksilver guy said to Laurent, man, what's this kid you just sent us? Are you kidding me? Like, what is he going to do? And I ended up finishing fifth in this contest back then with John. Everyone was there. All the best. Garrett Parks, Tamaro Amakom, Cristobal de Col, Peter San Crisanto, all the boys, you know, Wiggly.
And I did that. So my story started with Quickie, and then I was still living in Morocco. So I would go back to Morocco for the school, and on holidays, especially the summer holidays, I would go to France and, you know, do the contest during the 2 months of summer. And then, unfortunately, in 2005, I lost my dad. So that was a very tough part for me and for my family. Unexpected, you know, so that was very hard. And we decided to move in 2007. So 2 years after, we decided to move to Biarritz. And I mean, we wanted to move anyway from Morocco, because school was pretty expensive in Morocco, and in France, it's free, right? So, and we went to this region because, you know, I had surfing and I could continue and maybe, you know, do something with it there. So I went to surf school. I was at school and surfing in the afternoon. And I feel like that's a big, you know, like critical point of my surfing journey. I feel like, I'm not saying if I stayed in Morocco, it would have been, I would have never made it this far, but maybe, you know, because you get into a whole nother, another thing there, you know, you surf pretty much every day and, you know, you're around the best in Europe, you know, so you're surfing, you know, with good guys in the water. So you're pushing your level up and stuff and yeah, just surfing a lot. And then you're just in the scene, you know, back then Europe was big, you know, in surfing and, you're in the scene, you're in the, you know, the sponsor scene too. So you're not all the way in Morocco by yourself, you know? So that was the thing. That was the thing. And then first QSs and then boom, longer few years on the QS to finally qualify last year, 2 years ago. Yeah, last year.
Life has a way of shaping us through its challenges. As we heard from Ramsey, adversity came early, forcing him to confront loss and responsibility at a young age.
Like I said, you know, of course, especially the first year, bro, it was very tough because it's a whole thing. You know, you're still a kid. You know, I was 12. You lose your dad. You're like, wow, you have your life. You have your friends. You have, you know, the climate in Morocco is, you know, it's nothing compared to the France one in the winter. So, you know, there's so many things that come into this, you know. And but in the other side, you know, it's a good thing in terms of me growing up. You know, I had to grow up faster, me and my brother. That's it, you know, because in Morocco, you have everyone. You have the woman to cook, the woman to clean the, you know, your clothes. So we are really lucky in Morocco, you know, and to be there in an apartment with my mom working from 8 or 7:30 a.m. till like 6 p.m. every single day. And us, you know, me and my brother, we had to like, okay, whoa, there's no one here. You know what I mean?
In the face of personal loss, Ramsey found strength in his community. The village rallied around him with local surfers stepping in to guide and support both Ramsey and his brother.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few locals, you know, in Morocco, a few older surfers that I grew up, you know, watching them, you know, especially at Anchor Point. When I was going to Anchor Point, it was big. I was scared. I was sitting on the rocks watching. I mean, big. Back then, for me, it was big. And no, it was pretty big, you know. But I was like, wow. And I was watching a few locals that rip, you know. Especially, you know, like there's a few names. Karim Elbihi, he was goofy footer. He had a sick back end. I feel like he had the sickest style. I watched him a lot. There's a lot of locals, you know. Zuhir from Anchor Point, Christophe Shemsdine. There's a whole crew, you know, of all the guys. And when we were small, Kamel Herboula as well, you know. And then Laurent Miramon, Laurent Miramon was pretty much my mentor, you know, the one I told you from up north from the surf school. He's the one who really like took me and, you know, said to my parents, like, your kid has something and pushed me, you know, pushed me into surfing deeply, you know. And so yeah, he was my biggest mentor. But there's a few guys, you know. And then growing up with Otman, even other friends, you know, there's other guys like Lou. We had a nice little crew. Ali, you know, we had nice little crew of best friends that we would go surf there, you know, surf and push each other, you know, push each other.
The path to professional surfing is grueling. For Ramsey, a decade on the qualifying series meant relentless dedication and constant support from those around him.
You know, it's a journey, bro. You know, it's a journey, and QS is hard. Honestly, it's very hard. I feel like it's the jungle because, man, people rip. No, it's true, bro. People rip, like everyone rips, and conditions are really hard. And man, you can easily, I mean, you can easily get into, you know, and even me, like I feel like I could have qualified earlier as well, you know, is that, you know, you do your little mistakes, you know, you do your little road, you know, you learn while, you know, on the road, and it's a whole thing, you know, and yeah, it took me 10 years. I could have done it earlier, I'm pretty sure. But that was it. That was my journey. That was how it was supposed to happen. And it's hard, man. Honestly, it's hard. I had a few times where I wanted to stop, to be honest. Especially one time, I feel like it was in 2019. I really wanted to stop. I was feeling like pretty much depressed, honestly. I had anxiety and stuff like that. I was bummed. Like, I didn't want to surf anymore. And I said it to my coach back then. I told him, I'm done. Huh? I'm really done. And I don't want it anymore. I don't feel good. I don't feel happy. And he told me that was right before the qualification of the first Olympics. It was in 2019. And he told me, Ramsey, look, give me these four next events. And then if you don't want to go to Hawaii, you don't go to Hawaii. And then you stop. That's it. But just give me that. And in those four events, it was the Miyazaki contest, the qualification for Tokyo in Japan, right? So first contest, we go, boom, Pantene, boom, I'm surfing great in free surf. I feel great. Boom, I lose first round with 2-3 points. I'm like, wow. I'm like, okay, this is it. This is it. Like, this is putting me even, you know, I'm like more sure about quitting now, you know? And then we go to Japan and I get there. I don't know what I have to do to qualify. Honestly, I don't expect anything. Like I'm at the lowest of my career. I just wanted to surf. That's it. And I got there and I ended up qualifying for Tokyo. And that was the switching point. I was like, wow. You know, I didn't realize, but when I came home and I saw the buzz, the whole thing that, you know, was happening, I was like, wow, actually, you know, there's a lot of people looking up to you and supporting you, you know, like a lot. You cannot do this, you know, like wake up. And it gave me a fresh, you know, reading again. And after the next year, so 2020, first contest, I go to Brazil, I win, boom, 5-star. I'm like, wow, this is big. This is it. That's it. It's a switching point for me. I'm on, you know, and then COVID, boom. COVID comes, then it stops me again in my thing. No contests. Boom. Blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh, la, la. You know, everyone had a hard time in COVID. I'm like, wow, this was my momentum switch. And now, you know, again, we're going through some weird phases, you know. But I was like, in my head, I was like, no, no, no. It's happening. In this next year or two, you're in. That's it. I don't know. Something clicked, you know. It's true that I made way more sacrifices as well than before when I was younger, and I just committed to it fully, and I knew what I had to do after all these years, the experience. I knew the mistakes I've done many times, you know. I was like, okay, just boom, control all that and do your best and give your best until the end, not for months or two, until the end. And then if it doesn't happen, well, it doesn't happen, but at least no regrets, you know. And I did it, and I qualified right there. So, man, you see, the life is crazy, bro. Like, it's a roller coaster. Because look, I just qualified. I just had the best year of my life, right? I was in Hawaii. Boom, I took a flight. Boom, went all the way to Qatar to watch the World Cup. Morocco has the best World Cup in the history. I'm having a crazy time. All Moroccans are, you know, united. It's crazy time for sports in Morocco, you know, Moroccan sports. And then 1 month later, I go to Hawaii before the first event of my dream since I'm a kid. Boof, I break my ankle. Biggest injury I've had in my whole career. In a month part, you know? It's crazy. So you go from the highs of highs to the lows of lows. And I was like, no, I couldn't believe it was happening to me. When it happened under the water, I was like, no, no. I knew it was serious. I thought I broke my leg. But then I was like, no, I knew it was something wrong. I knew it, but I couldn't believe. I didn't want to believe it. So I tried. Even, man, I had 5 ruptured ligaments, and I tried. to put my foot in a boot for 10 days and like thinking I'm surfing pipe. I was like, no, I'm doing it. And when I went to France, I showed the guy, the surgeon, he's like, man, what were you thinking, bro? Like, your ankle is gone, man. You need a big surgery. Like, no way you can surf. No way. But you know, it was just hard to swallow. But then I feel like, and that's where you have to be strong as an athlete, because then you cannot get into that phase of, you know, questioning everything and going dark and deep into the bad thoughts, you know, like, wow, why me? Why is this happening to me? What did I do? Blah, blah, blah. Of course, they go through your mind. Huh? I'm not lying. I would be lying if I said no, but you have to be stronger and able to, you know, get rid of those thoughts and start switching process to, okay, what I have to do to recover and to be back there, where I was like 10 days ago. What do I have to do to get back to that position?
If Ramsey's story tells us anything, the Takazu area seems to breed incredibly resilient and determined individuals. But it's clear that this small town's influence extends far beyond the domain of surfing. Because while the waves may have put Takazu on the map, the rich mix of cultures, traditions, and flavors truly make this place world-class. Morocco, and by extension Takazu, is a melting pot in every sense of the word. Over the centuries, a diverse blend of influences has left its mark on the country's culinary landscape. The Arabs brought spices and dried fruits from the Far East in the 7th century, while the Moors introduced olive trees and oil. The Ottomans left their impression with barbecue grills, and the French added a European twist to the mix just over 100 years ago. But it's the Amazigh, the indigenous people of the region, who perhaps had the most profound impact on Morocco's food and culture. Slow-cooked stews like tagines, named after the pot in which they are prepared, and shared dishes like couscous are just a few of the culinary traditions that have been passed down through generations of Amazigh families. This spirit of hospitality and the sharing is at the very heart of Amazigh culture. Regardless of means, the Amazigh have always opened their homes and their hearts to visitors, embodying the true meaning of their name, free people. And there is no better ambassador for the Amazigh people than Mariam El Gardoum, a 5-time Moroccan surf champ, who wears her Amazigh identity loud and proud. Raised in the sleeping fishing village of Tamrat, just a stone's throw away from Takazu, Mariam's story is one of breaking stereotypes and navigating the balance between tradition and the modern world. Growing up as the only girl among a pack of boys, Mariam faced her fair share of challenges. In a community where women were often discouraged from sports or even leaving the house, Mariam's love for surfing could have easily been stifled, but thanks to the support of her parents, she was able to pursue her passion and shatter expectations along the way. It's a story that reflects the very essence of Morocco, a country that is constantly evolving, yet deeply rooted in its rich cultural traditions.
I live in Tamrat. I'm original from Tamrat, and I born there, and even my family. And I started surfing when I was 11 years, and I started competing. I went 5,000 Moroccan champion, and now I stop competing. And I'm a surf instructor and a surf guide.
Mariam is many things: a 5-time Moroccan champ, a surf guide, and a business owner. But first and foremost, she's an Amazigh woman. The Amazigh are the indigenous people of North Africa, with a rich cultural heritage predating Arab influence in the region.
Amazigh, it's in my blood, so which is I'm 100% Amazigh. So and I grew up in a family who keeps teaching us like the traditional thing, like Amazigh, and we like in the house we keep speaking in Tamazigh. And also when I was young, I had an issue with when I was studying, I don't even know how to talk Moroccan Arabic, so it took me longer, and everyone was Latin on my accent, which is like, you know, it's a Amazigh accent, but I'm proud of it. So yeah, I would say in the bit like 10 years ago, being Amazigh, most of the people, they are not like proud of saying I'm Amazigh, but like for me, it's all the time. Yeah, I'm Amazigh. I love my original. So yeah, and I never forget that we are the first people in the north of Africa. So and if we will say like, is all the Moroccans are Amazigh? I will say 90% of them are Amazigh. You know, just they get mixed with Arabic. So which is like Morocco got colonized from Arabic, and most of us we become Muslims. I'm Muslim. So this is the thing that this doesn't make any difference between us. So we respect each other. We live in the same country. So we don't have any issue between each other. Even sometimes, you know, there is racism between, you know, like, which is, yeah, you are Amazigh, but, you know, I don't care about it. You know, we are, for me, the most important thing is to respect each other. And even there is some few Moroccans who doesn't accept that Amazigh existed.
You might know the Amazigh people as Berbers, but as Maryam explained, this isn't their preferred name. The term Berber carries a negative meaning, originally used to describe savage.
Normally, people that used to call us Berber, which is savage. For us, we don't really accept someone to call us Berber. We are not savage. for us, it's Amazigh. Amazigh, we are free people.
Maryam is proud of her DNA, serving as an ambassador for the first people who settled in North Africa.
And even we didn't really study about our history, you know? It makes me sad. You know, like when I was in the school, I didn't even know that Amazigh, they were the first people in the north of Africa. Just I was searching by myself, which is, you know, like normal. We should study that at the school. We should know more about our history. We were studying about like European history, which is, you know, like it's not our culture. It's not our country though. So yeah. I'm proud, and Amazigh is in my blood until the last day in my life. I would say Amazigh people from like before they become Muslims, it was also like still, they were hard, especially like being a female. It's not easy though. The only thing is it's about growing up, getting married, having kids, and take care of your family. This is the only thing. And I was inspired from Deya. She was out of this way. She was like taking another way, which is she's following her dream. Like she was a fighter. Her dad was teaching her, you know, like, and like when her dad passed away, she became a queen. And everyone wasn't like, they didn't accept about that in the beginning, which is like the girl, she has to stay at the house, etc. But when Deya, she did that, most of the girls, they start getting, you know, following her, which is, you know, that like they want to make them dream come true. It's not only like being a mom or being a wife. It's a part of our life, but it's not the important thing in our life. There is a lot of things to do. So yeah, this is one of the things. And for me, when I was young, I'm not gonna lie, when I started surfing, I had a lot of problems, a lot of issues, which is people in my village, because in Tamraght, most of the people there are my family, you know, are my blood, you know, we are sharing the blood. So, which is Amazigh, first thing, we get married between each other, you know, we don't go out to the other village to get married or something, you know, and everyone there is my family. And so, yeah, they didn't really accept like it, just like seeing a girl, a surfer girl, like going with the boys. For them, it's like, no, this is not our culture. She doesn't have to do that, etc. But in the end, I showed that like it's a sport. It's not something bad that I'm doing. So, but when I get the respect, the moment I win my first Moroccan champion when I was 14 years, and everyone is proud of me, I was like, okay. Now I got you. So yeah, and then they completely changed. And I was saying, imagine I did stop surfing, and I didn't show them that it's a sport. I didn't show them it's different thing. It's not something bad. So like they won't understand about it. They're gonna keep all the time saying, oh, this is not for a woman. Oh, this is not for a woman. You know, because for them, like the only one who goes to the sea, it's a fisherman. And then when they see a woman going to the ocean, it means like, you know, you are not respecting your culture, etc. But I do. It's a sport. I love it.
As an Amazigh woman, a Muslim, and a surfer all at once, she skillfully navigates the intersection of old traditions and modern pursuits.
First thing, if my family wasn't behind me, that would be a big, big struggle. Because I'm not going to find the support. So I'm glad that my dad is a fisherman. And my mom, she used to... she was like taking care of us, but sometimes when there is a big tide, especially like when it's low tide, she goes to the rock, like to Diffel's Rock, my home spot, and then she keeps selecting mussels from the rocks. There is special like a season for it, and then she keeps selling that to the locals or the tourists, and you know, she knows how to swim. Both of them, they love ocean. So this is the first thing that did a big change, which is like they don't. When I told them. Dad or mom, I'm going to the beach. There is no, oh no, it's dangerous for you. They know ocean is dangerous, but you just know how to deal with it. And yeah, first thing, my family, and I'm a challenger. I'm a challenger person. Since I was young, if you told me you can't do that, I'm going to focus on that. I'm going to do it. You know, even if you don't want to, I'm on the way to make it happen. But of course, like this word hurts when someone keeps saying, oh, it's not for you, etc., you can't do it. I keep hiding, crying, and then 5 minutes of crying, and then back to work again. So this is how I am.
I asked her about the interplay between Islam and Amazigh culture, exploring their differences and similarities.
I would say we are living... First thing first, we are living in a man's country, which is most of the priorities is for men, and I totally respect that. It doesn't make any change in my life. You know, I don't care. I'm focusing on my goals. I can't do that. I don't care if it's a man country or a woman's country. So, but yeah, this is the thing. On men's, they get more support. And the woman, I would say, in Islam, there is some few rules. There is rules that we should respect, but yeah, like people who's gonna watch this broadcast or hearing that, they're gonna say, "Our first thing, you should wear your hijab, etc." I can do like for the moment, I'm happy like that. One day, I can do that if I want. I'm listening to my heart. I'm not putting a pressure on something that I'm not ready to do it, and. There is people who's mixing between a culture and Islam. And there is a huge difference. In Islam, like Prophet Muhammad said, you can teach your kids, which is he didn't mention boys or girls. You can teach them swimming, riding horses. So this is one of the important thing. And swimming, it means surfing also. Before that, we don't have a swim pools. So then it's the ocean. So this is the thing. So, like, it's a sport. You have to teach your kids a sport, something that they can do, and they can get a good health. So it's one of the best thing they can do. So which is swimming, riding horses. So yeah, and this is the thing. Like, but people they keep forgetting that it's on. They keep saying, "Oh no, it's only boys, boys, boys. A boy can do whatever he want. A girl, no, she doesn't have." In a dream, she doesn't have to dream. She doesn't have to do nothing. This is a culture. This is not Islam. Islam, girl, she can study. A girl, she can be a businesswoman. A wife of a prophet, Muhammad, she was a businesswoman. And so in Morocco, we keep mixing about the culture and Islam. We have a lot of traditional things. So Arabic. Amazigh, we do have different traditional thing, like culture, which is the ones in Agadir, Sousse, we call it Souassa, and then the ones in Atlas Mountain, or the ones more in the north, we have completely different culture. We have the same flag, which is like the ones in the blue, green, yellow, and we have the Z, like in a red, which is a blood. But if we went there, the Berber is completely, like Amazon is completely different, which is the accent. I can't really understand them. So this is the first thing. We have totally different culture, and then Arabic, like they are here, they keep mixing between Amazigh culture and Dim culture. It makes like a huge salad between, and then Islam, it makes it like, you know, most of people, they don't know, especially girls, they don't know which way they have to follow. So this is the thing. And for me, I'm trying to take like the way that I'm happy with, you know, like first thing first, I'm respecting my religion, even, you know, I have to do it 100%, but I'm doing my best. And also like, I'm like, for me, Amazigh, it means a lot to me. So this word means a lot to me, like, which is someone who keeps saying Amazigh or something, you know, like it makes me angry. Like my culture is the first thing. It's, you know, I found out like Amazigh, a woman or Amazigh people, they are strong, you know. If you want something, we can get it.
Our focus shifted to how she navigates her faith and beliefs within modern surf culture.
Because there is a connection between being patient, fighting for your turn, or, you know, like for your dream or your goal. It's the same thing. You know, like it's the same thing being a surfer, or just, you know, like now being a business woman in surfing. For me, it's like I keep here, like for me it makes a big difference, because you need to really fight for it. I was thinking that having a surf school, it's easy, you know, you just be a surf instructor and teaching, pushing in the water, all good. Oh, no. It's completely different. It looks easy when you are working for someone. But when it's your own thing, it's a lot of hard work. So, yeah, and the thing that I keep saying, my mom, she keeps telling me, nothing is easy. Just fight for it. And honestly, I become from a poor family, which is we didn't have, you know, a perfect life. But now, alhamdulillah, we do have a good life, because we were fighting for it. We weren't like, we didn't say, this is how God wants us to live, or etc. No. Man, move on. So this is what I learned from my family, and I'm proud to be Amazigh.
As the sun sets over the weather-beaten town on the Atlantic coast, casting a warm glow over Anchor Point, I can't help but reflect on the incredible journey that has brought us here. From the moment we set foot in this vibrant little town, it was clear that we were in for something special. I got to meet Saad El-Khalani, who paved the way for surfing in Morocco, and watched his treasured hometown transformed into a global surf destination. I spent time with big wave charger Oman Chofani, who exemplifies the spirit of hospitality and the delicate balance between tradition and progress. And we've been inspired by the stories of resilience and determination, like that of Ramzi Boukhiam, who has overcome countless setbacks to become a true ambassador for Arab surfing on the world stage. But perhaps most striking of all has been the mix of cultures and traditions that make this place so unique. Morocco is a melting pot in every sense of the word. And nowhere is this more evident than in the streets of Taghazou, where the call to prayers pierces through the narrow alleys spilling with surf shops, hip cafes, and street vendors selling culinary delights on the go. As I pack my bags and prepare to bid farewell to this special corner of the world, I can't help but feel a sense of gratitude for all that I've experienced here. The waves may have brought me to Taghazou, but the people, the culture, and the invincible spirit of this town will stay with me long after I've left. And so, with board styled for my next trip and a full heart, I set my sight on the horizon, ready for whatever adventure the next chapter may bring. Because if there's one thing I've learned from my time in Morocco, it's that the world is full of surprises and untold stories waiting to be discovered. Until next time, and thanks for listening. I'm Sunny Fassler, and I'm signing off from the land of right-hand points. Shukran.